Hi, Ron.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good. Thanks for joining us. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and this is The Wright Show. You are Ron Campius. You haven't been on Blogging Heads TV before. You just informed me that you have been a viewer, and I'm flattered. Before we get started, I want to say that I want to pay you a compliment. I mean, I think you really are kind of a reporter's reporter. I mean, the line between reporting and opinion has kind of gotten blurred in the modern media environment. And you are someone who I think really takes pains to call it straight. And you know, none of us can completely overcome our biases and our perspective. And you have a perspective like everyone. But I really think you are devoted to the ideal of impartial reporting, however unrealizable the ideal. Now let me tell people what kind of reporting you do. You're the, I think, Washington bureau chief for JTA. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Now JTA. Tell us a little about that. It stands for Jewish Telegraphic Agency, which suggests to me that it's not a startup. I don't think that name was coined in Silicon Valley within the last 5 years, right?
No, it started in 1917 in London. This journalist, Jacob Landau, was concerned that there was a lot of news coming out of the theater war in the First World War, and that was inspiring a lot of relief coming from the West, particularly the United States. But his perception was, and I think historically it's accurate, that Jews were actually suffering more, but a lot of the relief wasn't getting to them. There wasn't enough news about what was happening to the Jews in the Pale of Settlement in Europe. And so he set it up so Jews in the United States could be better informed. And it took off from there, because subsequent decades in the 20th century would prove that there were even more acute situations in which Jews were in trouble. And there was a thirst for knowledge of what was going on with those Jews in trouble. They even set up, JTA set up, all the Jews were expelled from Nazi-occupied Europe, they set up a pretend news agency that sent non-Jewish journalists into Nazi-occupied Europe to continue reporting on the plight of the Jews. And so it's a wire service. It sees itself like the Reuters or the AP of the Jewish media world. There are about 100 subscriber papers in the States. There are a few subscribers overseas, Israel, Australia, France, Britain. And so that's how it works.
So was word of the Holocaust getting out via JTA in a way that it wasn't getting out into mainstream media? I mean, the New York Times, for example, has been criticized, I think, for not reporting on it, maybe even after there was reason to think they should have known it was going on.
Yeah. A lot of the first reporting came out of JTA at the time, from what I understand. And if you look at Daniel Shore's, the late great NPR correspondent, if you look at his autobiography, he worked for JTA for the first 7 years of his career. And it's kind of funny. He describes why he left. First, he didn't want to have to write the annual Columbus Day column that started off, Columbus was not Jewish, but his navigator was. Because there was a lot of people always thought Columbus was Jewish. So he got sick of that. And I sympathize with that. But he was also sort of depressed because he would see the incoming copy. He would send it out, and the Jewish papers would publish it. But then he would see the mainstream media at the time was ignoring the copy coming out of Europe and the atrocities that were kind of happening to the Jews in Europe. So definitely, JTA at the time was a conduit for information that wasn't being played out elsewhere in the media.
Okay. And today, I mean, to look at the site and to pay attention to the stuff you're doing, at least, it seems to be thriving. And certainly making an impact. I think your work is followed by other people who report on this, write about it, think about it, by this, I mean a lot of things, but certainly, several things we're going to talk about today, come within your ambit, I think. Let's start off with the Paris thing.
Mm-hmm.
You and I were involved in a Twitter exchange a day or two ago, I guess.
Right.
We were talking about this issue. It started off with Ted Rall, the cartoonist, saying he didn't. I think he said something like he didn't abide by any taboos. This is about whether there should be taboos on cartoons of prophets, for example. I guess you retweeted him, and And I argued that, well, you know, there are taboos in the United States about what you can say and what you can't. We do practice some degree of self-censorship. The media does. In various realms, to avoid offending various groups, various ethnic groups, right?
Right. Right.
So, so we got into that. That's become kind of a debate in itself. I don't know if you saw the Glenn Greenwald thing, where you know he. So is there anything you want to say on this subject generally? The question of taboos and.
Yeah, I think it's true that that we're more susceptible to self-imposed taboos in the United States than they would be in France. And it's part of the French cultural tradition. You've got a history going back at least to the Enlightenment, a very ribald humor targeting anyone and everybody in the most outlandish terms. And I think, you know, I think the French are less, in terms of racism, in terms of the other, they're less reluctant than Americans are to appropriate the imagery of bigots in order to dismantle them. And I think that's what went on a lot with Charlie Hebdo and wasn't really understood on this side of the Atlantic. That tradition exists here, and maybe Americans would understand it better if they saw these examples, in underground comics. And so, you know, Art Spiegelman famously wrote his two volume work, Mouse, and he chose mice to represent Jews during the Holocaust because the Germans had depicted them as vermin. And then, you know, a more controversial example is Robert Crumb had a comic in the 1970s, I think it was, called Angel Food McSpade, and it was a stereotype of the sort of big black woman that I think what a lot of white men might find intimidating, but he used it to confront white imaginings about powerful blacks and powerful black women, and you know, and he got into trouble for that because there are people who will see the image and the, you know, the one's reaction to an image is so visceral that you don't want to necessarily deal with the fact that what's being happening is here is that the image is being deconstructed. So I think that was part of it with Charlie Hebdo, but the other part of it is that it's a blaspheming magazine, and it believes in blaspheming every deity, and yeah. And I think that, you know, with Glenn Greenwald's piece, he contrasted it with cartoons that didn't blaspheme Jewish deities, although actually there were plenty of those in Charlie Hebdo, but he contrasted it with cartoons that played into racist tropes about Jews, which is something quite different than what Charlie Hebdo was doing, coming from its tradition. I had an exchange with Yusuf Menayer on Facebook. He's the director of the Palestine Institute here, and he was saying, well, would you say I am Stormfront or something like that if somebody went in and killed all the editors of that white supremacist right. publication? And my answer was, you know, Stormfront was started. Yeah, I would obviously want justice for whoever killed them, but Stormfront was started as a white supremacist publication. Its raison d'etre is white supremacy. Charlie Hebdo was started as an iconoclastic publication, and sometimes sometimes that's going to take you into areas that are uncomfortable in terms of combating political correctness, but its raison d'etre was never ever to marginalize Muslims or to marginalize North Africans. It was to pick apart taboos.
Right. Well, there certainly are distinctions. I think the point Glenn was making, and it's kind of a point I've made, although characteristically Glenn made it in a somewhat more provocative way than I have made the argument.
Right.
But what he was doing, he was responding to the argument that in extreme form came from John Chait when John said something like, if you're going to defend free speech, you have to defend the speech itself, the content of the speech. So in this case, if you're really serious about defending the right of these cartoonists, you have to defend, even promulgate the cartoons themselves. And Glenn said, no, first of all, these are two separate issues. You can, you know, defend the right of free speech without defending the content. And he mentioned the Skokie March, you know, of the Nazis and so on, which civil right. libertarians defended, but they weren't defending anything those guys were saying. And so then Glenn trotted out these anti-Semitic cartoons, basically saying, look, if you really believe in this principle, John Chait, you know, you tell me, would you embrace this particular, the content of this particular speech? And the implied answer being no. So I don't think Glenn is denying that there are differences between the cartoons, you know, and the anti-Semitic cartoon, the Parisian cartoons, the anti-Semitic cartoons. But he is making that point. I agree with him on that, that we shouldn't pretend that there are no taboos in America, that there's no de facto censorship in America. And I personally am a defender of it. I personally think it has been responsible for maintaining ethnic harmony in the United States in at least some minimal sense compared to many multi-ethnic societies. There's a lot of taboos surrounding, the N-word, famously.
Right.
And I guess the question I would ask about the Parisian cartoons is, you know, I guess in America, we kind of let the ethnic group decide what it offends it in a certain sense, you know?
Right.
And I would ask, well, how do these cartoons look to French Muslims and Muslims generally? And I think to an extent that people don't appreciate, there are some mainstream Muslims who consider them offensive just because there is this issue with presenting images of Muhammad. And so, you know, when people say, "I am Charlie," I think that is itself taken as an affront by, it would be easy, you know, there's a lot of Muslims in France. They have varying degrees of education and sophistication, like all populations. And you can well imagine a non-trivial number of them saying, "Oh, so you embrace intentional insults of Muslims." And that's why I personally draw a distinction between defending the right to publish a cartoon and going around saying, "I am Charlie," which I am not saying.
Right. I understand that to a degree, and I think I would reject, John Chait's predicate that you have to defend the speech itself. You know, like I said, I brought up the issue of Stormfront. I would never embrace that speech. I would defend the right to have it published, but I wouldn't embrace it. And there is self-censorship. But I think that you're right in that we allow minorities to define to a degree what offends them. But I think that's not such a great thing because subjectively, I mean, it plays out in my little world as well, where there are people who will say criticizing Israel, you know, even let's say harshly criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic. I think we can, you know, as a society come up with ideas of what is objectively racist, what objectively will harm a community, and what separately, objectively, might offend members of a community, but that doesn't end up marginalizing them, making them the other, and causing them to suffer actual harm. And if you're publishing, if Charlie Hebdo is publishing, is blaspheming Muhammad, but is also blaspheming the papacy and blaspheming Jewish traditions, it's okay. You know, that's something that I think we can collectively say we can not necessarily embrace it, but forgive it as part of an embrace of satire more broadly.
Yeah, but the other distinction I'd make, and this has something to do with how the extent to which we let the interest group define, the sensitivity. In America, we give special deference to relatively powerless groups, I think. I mean, there's nothing you can say about a white person that is taboo. There are slurs like honky, but you can get by with them. They don't offend me. I think the reason they don't offend me is because I don't, feel like a trampled upon minority.
Right.
And so we do have this asymmetry. And in France, really unlike the United States, the Muslims are, in socioeconomic terms, in terms of income and so on, are in the aggregate at least, at kind of a lower level. And in the United States, it's a different demographic, actually, a Muslim that has tended to immigrate to the United States. So it's a little different here. But it is, in France, I would say, a relatively powerless minority group. So I think there is that to be said in terms of how you think about this.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. But I also think that power is fluid. It depends. It shifts from situation to situation. I think that when you have an act in Paris that's taking place that is reflective of acts that take place in countries where Muslims are preeminent, like Iran or Saudi Arabia, in terms of killing or punishing blasphemers, one it can take into account that power relationship as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm just basically worried that that for example, Charlie Hebdo publishing, putting Muhammad again on the cover, things like that are actually going to make the situation worse. And as you know, I mean, there's a serious problem, obviously, with Jews in France increasingly feeling imperiled. And there are also now attacks on mosques and so on. I'm really worried about this thing kind of getting out of control. And I think it's one of the cases where, you know, it may be judicious to say, yes, you have the right to do this, and yet then go on to discourage it, you know, and that's what I'm doing, but, it's a tough thing.
Yeah.
So nothing else you want to say on that subject before we move on?
I think we've exhausted it.
Yeah, pretty much. And in fact, I had already said everything I just said on Blogging Heads. So I've exhausted it twice. So a couple of big issues, that may in some ways be related at a political level, that you're paying attention to. There's the Iran negotiations,
right,
and an attempt in Congress to pass some sanctions legislation that the administration thinks would imperil the negotiations. These are nuclear negotiations designed to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. Then there's the Palestinian attempt to increasingly to use the United Nations as an avenue of influence. Notably, the International Criminal Court, and there's a resolution that didn't pass, but I gather they're going to resubmit it to the Security Council.
I think they said they would resubmit it to the Security Council. I don't think they have a deadline yet, but they're going to.
Now, is that for is that a statehood resolution or?
Yeah, what they tried to get through the Security Council on New Year's Eve was, or just before the new year, was a statehood resolution. The ICC business is separate. The ICC, it's interesting because in order to become a member nation of the ICC, you do have to be validated by the UN Secretary General, but it is an entity that's independent of the United Nations, and which is one of the interesting wrinkles in that is that existing U.S. law would cut off funding to the Palestinians in any that for becoming a state level member of a UN body. And that there were a lot of Republicans, a lot of people before this played out that thought that this would apply to the ICC. It doesn't because there's a term, a legal term, specialized agency of the UN. The ICC is not that. So at least for the immediate future, the Palestinians by applying to join are not in danger of getting funding cut. And what's happening on the Hill is that you're getting people to try and fill in what they're saying is a loophole in terms of penalizing the Palestinians for doing this. They're trying to make membership in the ICC cut off the Palestinian funding, and they are also trying to they're trying to penalize the Palestinians for if they go ahead with any prosecution through the ICC.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand this. American Congress had already passed legislation saying the Palestinians will be penalized if they succeed in getting formal recognition of statehood in the United Nations?
Yeah. Exactly.
Which they haven't quite yet. There's some informal sense in which their statehood is increasingly recognized in certain halls of the UN, and I don't understand all that, but the Security Council certainly has not said yes.
Right.
And then you're saying, much to the disappointment of some in Congress, it turns out that this law would not apply to Palestinian membership in the International Criminal Court. And so now they're trying to remedy that by coming up with punitive legislation in that realm.
Right.
Now, the U.S., I read yesterday, has guaranteed the Israeli government that they will veto a second Palestinian attempt to get the Security Council to grant them statehood. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, with the I'm not exactly sure what the makeup of the Security Council is now. You know, it changes every 6 months, I think. And what's interesting about the last bit is that the Palestinians were not likely to get the 9 votes out of 15 that are needed that would have to trigger the U.S. veto. And that saved the Americans a lot of embarrassment because what they're doing, the Palestinians are smart. They're creating these resolutions in language that nobody, in terms of the of American policy on Palestine that nobody could really credibly object to. And so then if it gets to the point where, you know, it does get that 9 threshold and it does go to the Security Council and then the U.S. exercises veto, it becomes harder for the United States to rationalize its veto. And so I think the Israelis might have been concerned because now the thinking is, I'm not exactly sure what the particulars are, the thinking is that now they're likely to get the 9. They're likely to get the 9, and the Israelis are worried that the Americans might balk because they don't want to be embarrassed. In other words, they might simply abstain from voting, and then the resolution would go through, and they're just, and it sounds like they've got an assurance from the Americans that that won't happen, that they'll veto in any case.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know. I mean, statehood, I guess, would make it easier for the Palestinians to pursue various things in the UN. But, you know, they would all just be pieces of paper, you know? I mean, do you think it makes sense for Israel to be as afraid of this as they are? Because, I mean, after all, Israel has not proven reluctant in the past to defy UN resolutions if necessary, right? I mean, it just seems like it's not like it changes facts on the ground, right? Anything the Palestinians do, either through the ICC or through the UN broadly.
Well, yeah, through the UN broadly, through the Security Council is the only sort of agency of the United Nations that has any sort of kind of legal power. If you get Palestinian statehood recognized by the UN Security Council, then Israel could be seen as breaking international law in, I think, a lot more instances than it is now. So that's that would be a problem. And but they also, Israelis are very, very sensitive to the symbolic import of international recognition. I mean, there's a street in Jerusalem called Kaftet B'November, which means the 29th of November. It doesn't mark Israel's independence. It marks the UN recognition of Israel on November 29th, 1947. And so they are afraid of that kind of momentum stemming from what might be, you know, symbolic actions and developing into and hardening into actual isolation of Israel should it not comply with the international consensus that there should be a Palestinian state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess you're right. I mean, because as of now, okay, there's a resolution that seems to call for, I guess, withdrawal from the West Bank, but there's a lot of ambiguity having to do with a particular article, whether you write or something, whether it's an A or a D or something like that. There's a resolution that kind of hinges on that. And then there's the Geneva Convention that bans the transfer of civilian populations into occupied territory. But even, and I see your point that if Palestine becomes a state, then suddenly there's just obvious stuff like you're not allowed to have your troops in other people's states without their permission and so on, right? So that it does become a whole nother kettle of fish in terms of international law, right?
Right. And I mean, you know, the Palestinian and Israeli economies are like basically one economy now. If Israel keeps on exercising its privileges now to control the Palestinian economy in terms of exports, in terms of things, they could enter any sort of myriad international law situations, I think, that they'd rather avoid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anyway, it looks like they're safe for the time being. I mean, it doesn't look like anything is going to get past the Security Council.
No.
Now, of course, it's not surprising that the U.S. would make this guarantee to stand by Israel, in this case, at the Security Council. It's more or less consistent, you know, with our history. In one case, we did kind of go against Israel's wishes on an East Jerusalem resolution, I know, and kind of insisting that no, there's no any kind of annexation of East Jerusalem would not be recognized and so on. But by and large, the U.S. has stuck by Israel. So it's not surprising, but I wondered, could this be related to Iran in the sense that the Obama administration is more reluctant to ruffle the feathers of the Israeli government as they move toward a possible deal with Iran that Israel is not enthusiastic about and could in principle make trouble about, right?
You know, I think that's always been at the back of the thinking of the White House in terms of the Obama administration, in terms of of its dealings with Israel. It wants to, you know, they are very, very proactive in attempting to persuade the Israeli government that the negotiations are with Iran right now are the best way to contain any, or to stop any a nuclear state.
Mm-hmm.
And that would refract onto other parts of the relationship as well. They want to keep the Israelis on board. President Obama speaks very frequently with Netanyahu, and precisely for that's at least one of the reasons they don't want Israel to step out of line on Iran.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it could go as far as an actual explicit deal where Obama says, okay, we'll have your back at the Security Council? I mean, I doubt that he and Netanyahu are on sufficiently good terms to do deals at the moment, but do you think it's possible that they've actually talked about this and he says, we'll have your back at the Security Council, but you got to, you know, you can't be stoking the fires when it comes time to sell this deal here at home?
To sell the Iran deal?
Sell the Iran deal here in America.
I think that, you know, they might be proposing that. I think that the Netanyahu government would see they would rather see the reverse. They would rather see the Americans say, hey, come back to the negotiating table. Let's work out something. But we're going to listen to you more closely when it comes to Iran in terms of your demands, because the Israelis want Iran to come out of any deal with no enrichment, uranium enrichment capacity whatsoever. The Americans are saying, we'd like that too, but you're probably going to have to live with a 5% enrichment capacity. In other words, a peaceful
mm-hmm.
enrichment capacity. So the Israelis are saying, you know, talk to us whatever about the Palestinians, but just keep the Iran deal as restrictive as possible, which is why, you know, you're now getting in the Senate moves to revive the Iran sanctions legislation, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think the Israeli interest here is pressuring the Obama administration to maybe even to pull out of the talks with Iran, but to at least to hang tough in terms of whatever deal comes out.
Yeah, well, I think there's no chance that the Obama administration is going to revert to a position where they won't permit any enrichment. I think the question is whether they'll move in the direction of the Iranians. There's just a gap right now in terms of how many centrifuges and
right.
blah, blah, blah. I also suspect the Obama administration is a little skeptical of what good it does to take a few more steps toward peace between Israel and Palestine. We've taken a few steps a lot of times, and nothing ever happens, right? And there are things the Bibi can do down the road to sabotage it if he wants, that either side can do to sabotage it if they want. So I wouldn't personally really expect that. But it leads to the question of why the Iran thing is so important to Israel. I mean, the stated reason has to do with, you know, well, Iran could nuke Israel. Is it your read that that's really the big concern?
No, I think that, I mean, you know, as somebody... by the late Michael Adler, a guy who was an Iran analyst, a good friend of mine, you know, he said, he put it very well, for Israeli security apparatus can look at Iran developing a nuclear bomb and can say, they're never going to use it against us, it'll be fine. On the other hand, you can't function as a professional in charge of security for whatever country you're in and not attempt to prevent declared intentions to develop lethal weapons that could be targeted at you. So, whether or not the Iranians would actually nuke Israel or not is almost beside the point. If Cuba were to develop a nuclear policy, we'd laugh our hats off at the idea of this tiny nation trying to attack the United States. But that doesn't mean at the very same time somebody in the Pentagon would be plotting out how to prevent them from even advancing one inch on that case. So I think there's, and obviously the other thing that they're afraid of is just Iran having any kind of nuclear umbrella. In other words, it's being able to advance its hegemony in the region with the possible threat of any kind of nuclear action. They see, the Israelis in the past, before everything went to hell in a handbasket with Syria, the Israelis had this sort of fraught relationship with Syria. But one of its aspects was that they would work with Syria to in sort of opaque ways to contain Hezbollah, which Assad's father at least wanted to contain. If Iran has a nuclear bomb, Iran becomes the power that you're if you're a third party in the Middle East, if you're an Arab country, that you're more likely to want to deal with than with, or to defer to, than to Israel.
I guess, I mean, there are different views on that. You know, there is the view that it's so implausible that you would actually use a nuclear weapon in a first strike way that, you know, it, you know, and questions like, have nukes really done Israel even any good, even, right? I mean, it seems to me Israel's conventional deterrent is the effect, is the thing that people actually think about in Gaza, in Lebanon, you know, but, but at the same time, what you're saying is a conventional way of looking at it that including in national security circles. So is this, do you think this bill, the sanctions bill, and I'm not sure, is it a, it's Kirk and Menendez, I think, are the co-sponsors. Is it a bill that imposes sanctions in the event that the talks break down or that imposes them in any event?
It was a bill that imposed sanctions in the case that the talks broke down. That was the last iteration of the bill. From what I understand, it might now just trigger sanctions in any event. I'm not sure whether a final draft has come forward yet. I know that there is resistance on the Democratic side to that kind of language. Even in Menendez's office, they don't want to cut off Obama at the knees, even if there are disagreements with him on Iran.
Yeah, well, without Menendez's support, they probably could not get a veto-proof majority, right?
Right. And it's not just Menendez. It's not just the veto-proof majority. I mean, you know, the big thing that's happening here in 6 weeks, AIPAC is having another one of its policy conferences. And they want to come out of there with legislation that you know, they have about 10 to 12,000 activists coming to Washington for this. And then they have the lobbying day. And they're going to want a workable bill that they can take up to the Hill and persuade as many lawmakers as possible to carry it through. If that bill is designed too much to completely emasculate Obama, to completely isolate them, I think AIPAC is going to have it's going to have a hard time, first of all, maintaining its credibility with Democrats on the Hill, and it's also going to have a problem with its rank and file. I mean, there's a Steve Sheffy, who's a Democratic Jewish activist in Chicago. He recently wrote a column for the Hill, I think, saying I'm a lifelong. And he is. I know the guy. He's a lifelong AIPAC member. Is pro-Israel, true and blue in the AIPAC definition of pro-Israel, and he's. He wrote, now is not the time to undercut the president with Iran sanctions. And, you know, that's something that the leadership is AIPAC is sensitive to. They don't want to be identified with one party and one party only.
So is it not even clear to you that AIPAC in the end would be pushing for an unconditional sanctions bill?
I'm not sure they wouldn't push for it. I can't count anything out. I do think that they would try to influence the bill to help shape it in a way that would make Democrats support it because they need that bipartisan support. And I don't think that you could have an immediate sanctions trigger in such a bill. They would have to, revert to the language of last year in which sanctions would kick in once the talks broke down.
I see. Okay. Yeah. That seems to me much less of a threat to the talks. I mean, I think the administration would still not be happy about it, and they might veto it, because I think their sense is anything perceived as disrespect in Iran is rhetorical ammunition for the hardliners who are the constraint on Rouhani as he tries to get a deal.
Right.
So can we get back to Charlie Hebdo for one
sure.
Second? One big issue has been the issue of French Jews migrating to Israel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Netanyahu kind of encouraged that, I think maybe when he was in France, but he's kind of been encouraging that. And I think there's been a variety of reactions among French Jews, some of whom were a little resistant to the idea, right? Or were ambivalent about the invitation or something, or do I have that wrong?
Yeah, I think that there's there was like a whole scene that's on YouTube where Netanyahu's visiting the Grand Synagogue in Paris, and they break out into La Marseillaise. You know, there it's like the Jews in the synagogue break out into La Marseillaise. You know, like in any country, I think there's a strong national identification for the Jewish community in France. They don't want to give up on it. I mean, French culture is one of those things. I think more than some other cultures, that once it has its grips into you, you just can't shake it. And certainly if you're born and raised in France, it's hard to imagine, you know, the rest of your lifetime without it. I mean, which is not to discount the fact that Jews are very, are spooked. So like out of 600,000 French Jews, 7,000 emigrated to Israel last year. That's like more than 1%. That's a chunk. But I think that the mistake that Netanyahu was perceived to have made, and Israelis were criticizing him for it, as well as diaspora Jewish communities, is that, you know, the role of Israel, the role of a robust and strong Jewish state in the 21st century, or is not simply to draw every single Jew in the world within its borders, but it's to empower Jews, you know, to help them shuck off centuries of inferiority complexes so they can stand up and defend themselves. And I think, you know, that's manifest itself in the States, in the United States, for instance, with the rise of Jewish political power, the fact that Jews are unafraid to run for Congress, they're disproportionately represented in Congress. Before Israel, you know, the reverse was true. The Jews felt more isolated. And so, you know, it's that nuanced take on what Zionism can mean for diaspora Jews that goes out the window when you go to a synagogue and say, everybody just come with me, follow me to Israel. And I think that's where the discomfiture among the French Jews came in.
Are there any signs that he now thinks it was a mistake himself?
No, I don't. I haven't heard any, and I doubt that there will be any, knowing Bibi. He doesn't own up to error very easily.
Yeah. Do you think it was a mistake in the context of the coming elections in Israel?
No, I think, you know, and, you know, everybody's saying that's really why he went to France, because of the coming elections in Israel. He has worked hard. I mean, I was working for AP when Yitzhak Rabin was elected in 1992. Mm-hmm. And I remember with my boss listening to his inaugural speech in the Knesset, and he said, the world is no longer against us. We have to accept that. And that was like one of the most, I mean, it was interesting because I think we were the only ones to pick up on that, but that was one of the most exciting and interesting things that an Israeli leader had said until that point. The world's no longer against us. We have to behave as a grown-up country with other countries and not constantly think that we're in danger of imminent demise. Mm-hmm. And certainly Netanyahu and the Likud do cultivate the world is against us type politics. And so in that context, going to France and saying, everybody pack up your bags and come to Israel, that plays to that those constituents in Israel who do favor that outlook.
I see. And do you have any predictions about the Israeli election?
You know, it's really hard. It's a three-way race. It's going to come down to, in terms of Netanyahu and Lieberman and their parties and the center with this new startup party led by Moshe Kahalon and Yair Lapid, and then the left with Labor merging with Tzipi Livni. Mm-hmm. And they keep on getting like 20 something seats out of 120 in terms of polling now. And then the question is, if you know, whoever does win, I mean, the president is the president technically is supposed to ask the leader of the party who has the best chance of putting together a coalition. It's interesting because the president is supposed to be a non-political figure, but that's actually maybe an essentially political decision.
Right.
So then in that case, that person has to go and persuade the ultra-Orthodox parties, because they do hold sway, that they can trust them to preserve some of their the privileges that they've accrued. And so in that sense, it's still a toss-up. Hmm. And the other interesting wrinkle, though, about that is getting enfranchising Arabs to vote. They are 20% of the population. And one of the interesting things I saw about Yitzhak Herzog, the Labour candidate, is that he is cultivating Arab Israelis. I mean, they're not necessarily to vote for Labour, but to vote for parties that ultimately would back Labour in a coalition.
Wait, I missed that. Can you say that again? So, I mean, hadn't there been this kind of informal agreement among the Jewish political parties in Israel that you would not be part of a coalition with one of the Arab parties, or do I have that wrong?
No, there is that informal agreement. What's interesting to me about Herzog's rhetoric is perhaps he's going to, for, you know, he might, he raises a possibility of not abiding by that any longer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what he's saying is, I mean, what he might be also saying, what's happened in the past is, go out, vote for your Arab parties, and also pressure them to work with me so they can support me from outside the coalition, because that's what happened with Rabin in the 1990s. He had Arab parties support from outside the coalition.
Mm-hmm. And is there any plausible outcome of this election that would really make a difference in the Israel-Palestine issue? In other words, is there an outcome that could really lead in some kind of straightforward way to a two-state solution?
You know, certainly if Herzog is elected, the prospects are much likelier, I think. I mean, he comes from a stream of thinking that's much readier to accommodate freezing settlement, dismantling some settlements, and working hard towards a two-state solution. You know, and we saw that with Olmert and Livni in the last iteration. The problem is that when you come up against a Palestinian failure of will to go the extra mile, and you know, it's scary for both sides. If you look at polling, like there's a guy, Khalil Shikaki, a Palestinian pollster who polls both societies. And it's interesting because when you ask, would you give up, you know, control over Jerusalem? Would you agree to a two-state solution? Whenever he adds at the end of every question, if that ends all issues, if that ends all claims, if that means, it always goes up when he adds that phrase, ends all claims. And I think that, you know, the problem for each side is the concern that if they do sign on the dotted line, that it wouldn't end all claims. And I think that that's what happened with Abbas. Well, that's what happened with Arafat in the years of negotiations he had with the Israeli government, particularly mm-hmm. afterwards, after Rabin's death. It's happened with Abbas, with Tzipi Livni and Olmert in 2008. They are reluctant to give up something vital to them on the off chance that it might not actually end all claims. And so, and that's, you know, so even if you do have an Israeli government that's amenable to that negotiation, you're running up against Palestinians who feel disenfranchised, weak, and maybe not being up to negotiate.
Right. And on the issue of right of return, that is to say the right of Palestinians whose ancestors, at least, had been displaced from Israel proper to return there. I think Livni, I mean, I've always thought that there could be a more or less token, you know, right of return granted. In other words, yes, you have the right, but there's only so many slots and the rest of you will have to settle for monetary compensation, something like that. But I gather in the last round of negotiations, Livni, who, she would be part of the Herzog coalition, that's the idea, yeah. and you're in the optimistic scenario. I think she was against even that. She was saying, no, right of return, as I saw the reporting, she was saying right of return cannot be on the table. It's just off, right? So she didn't seem to be headed for a token resolution of that issue even.
Yeah, that's certainly what evolved. I know that during the Camp David talks, what was revived, and I don't know to what degree it was seriously contemplated, was President Truman's proposal to David Ben-Gurion that he take in 100,000 Jews after the 1949 war. Mm-hmm. Sorry, take in 100,000 Palestinians after the 1949 war to end all claims. And Ben-Gurion was actually willing, and the Arabs at that time were not willing. And so that came up in 2000, maybe less than 100,000. But the idea, you know, that what was put to the Israelis was that you've contemplated, here's the paperwork, you've contemplated this kind of symbolic return in the past. If it gets us over the finish line, why not contemplate it now? So I understand where Tzipi Livni is coming from. There is a real, I mean, you know, the Israelis have an existential fear of being overwhelmed by an international, or being overwhelmed by a population that doesn't want to remain Israeli. So there's that, and that's what she's playing to. Like I said, the Israelis have actually talked about doing this in the past, so it's not inconceivable that they would return to figuring that one out.
And would you say, in general, just to get back to the original issue, the Paris issue, that Israeli fear, you know, including a kind of a fear of certain forms of the two-state solution, you know, a reluctance to kind of sign on to anything that seems to leave any loopholes at all, or any, you know, any danger of falling apart. I assume the fear has been exacerbated by the what happened at the kosher market in Paris in particular. I mean, you know, of course, you can argue these things either way. You could say, well, the worse things look on these fronts, the scarier things look on these fronts, the more sense it makes to try to solve the Palestinian problem. But on the other hand, as a practical emotional matter, in terms of the mindset of the Israelis who are doing the negotiating, it instills more fear, and fear is often not conducive to negotiation. How do you assess the net effect, you know, any connection between Paris and prospects on Israel-Palestine?
I think, it, you know, and Netanyahu's been exploiting this. I think it feeds into Netanyahu's, you know, overall underlying argument, although maybe not explicitly stated, that this is a conflict that needs to be managed, and we need to build fences to protect ourselves from these people, rather than a conflict that needs to be resolved through a diplomatic solution. I think that, yeah, you're right. I mean, during the Second Intifada, when Israelis were civilians were targeted, I think an especially symbolic moment was, I think, in 2002, when a suicide bomber went into a ballroom where there was a Passover Seder being held for a lot of recently arrived immigrants who couldn't organize their own. And I think he killed 13 people. That kind of thing, like, makes Israelis despair of the notion of that they could come into an agreement with their neighbors, that they feel that they're in a neighborhood where they're really not wanted, and there will always be parties that will do their best to end the idea of Israel and to harm Israeli civilians. And so, you know, to the degree that these attackers at the kosher supermarket ascribed to extremist Islamic, it's hard to even call them Islamic, but to extremist tendencies that are coming out of the Islamic world, I think that that validates that fear for them. And Bibi was politically smart to make that connection.
So even though this was not Palestinians in this case who were committing the violence, it has, you're saying, it has somewhat of the same psychological impact with respect to the Israel-Palestine issue.
Yeah, I think Israelis, for instance, noticed very clearly that Hamas condemned the attack on Charlie Hebdo, but not the attack on the kosher supermarket. And that'll lead them to say, well, we know who we're dealing with in this case.
That's interesting, because, you know, I think it was the reverse with Al-Qaeda in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, that anyway, it was Yemen-based Al-Qaeda, right, that takes responsibility for the attack on the magazine, but I think not on the market, as I understand it. Is that right?
That's right, and I think the that might have something to do with the fact that the gunman at the market was more identified with ISIS, and that he'd made that video in which he expresses identification.
Right. Maybe it's just that he wasn't willing to carry the Al-Qaeda brand. Okay. Well, this is all pretty depressing. So I guess in that frame of mind, I'll let you get back to your work. But thanks again, Ron. And I do recommend that people interested in any of these issues follow your work at jta.org.
Oh, thank you.
And on Twitter, it's just Campeas, right? Kampeas.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.